1962. And listen to the crowd welcome 1962 NBC Radio across the nation to you.
This is how it began, Year of Grace, 1962. These were the sounds at its midnight birth. In New York's Times Square, in Boston and Sioux Falls, in Cripple Creek they sang this song, and in Atlanta and Coon Rapids, Iowa. And the wisest of us there that night did not know what lay ahead in the year to come. January 1st, 1962. It was an ordinary day, a Monday. A light snow began to fall in many areas of the East. 197 persons had died in automobile accidents over the weekend, but still the figure was lower than expected. It was cold that day, and snow clouds hovered over the long Atlantic tidelands and stretched out into the Mississippi Basin. A lot of people felt a little unsteady that morning because of the celebrations of the night before, and some of them must have been a little short of cash. The cost of celebrating was up in most places. In Hollywood's Coconut Grove, 800 persons paid $37 each to dance and welcome in the year. The normally staid New York Times that morning published some suggested hangover cures. Bloody Marys were suggested. A Brandy Alexander, or for the truly miserable, something called Black Velvet, equal parts of stout and champagne, chilled and poured together. And the earth, comprehending neither beginning nor ending, kept its cosmic appointments and leaned hugely toward the spring. The year was yet young when, on the beach in Florida, a long, thin rocket was set up with its nose pointing toward the sky, toward infinity. On the morning of February 20th, before dawn had streaked the east, Lieutenant Colonel John H. Glenn, Jr. was up and about his affairs. He was examined and fed, and slowly and meticulously eased into his strange, unearthly clothing. 10 times this country had sought to orbit a man in space, but each try had ended in postponement, and this would be try 11. At first, things went well. T-minus, whatever, and counting. Dawn came, and crowds on Cocoa Beach. But the sun was reluctant. The original blast-off time was scheduled for 7:30. That moment came and passed. There were clouds and minor technical troubles. Perhaps this one, too, would be postponed. 8, 8:30, 9 o'clock, and then at 9:47 Eastern Standard Time, it happened.
8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. Ignition. Liftoff.
Liftoff. The clock is operating. We're underway.
Roger. Reading you loud and clear. Flight path looks good. Pitch 25. Stand by for staging.
Roger. Pico.
All over the world, they were listening to us and noting what we were doing. A thin ball of fire that quickly disappeared to the east. A voice out of space itself, and a woman in the crowd who said, "He's in the hands of the Lord now."
Zero G, and I feel fine. Capsule is turning around. Oh, that view is tremendous.
Roger, turnaround has started.
Capsule turning around, and I could see the booster during turnaround just a couple of hundred yards behind me. It was beautiful.
3 times he circled the Earth, and then, with almost the ease of a test run, he came back to Earth and landed deftly in the sea.
We have a long way to go in the space race. We started late, but this is the new ocean, and I believe the United States must sail on it and be in a position second to none.
Later, they would meet the President and John H. Glenn, a lieutenant colonel in the Marines. Stocky, sandy-haired, he had crag-like features that were softened by a smile that came quickly and easily. And we all had a new hero that day, and walked each of us with new pride. And the year, still fresh and new, was already marked and different from all the years that went before. Some things were the same, or almost so. A man down in Texas was arrested when it developed that his financial dealings were highly involved and suspect. His name was unusual and more suitable for a performer somehow than a tycoon, Billy Saul Estes. The year would end with his tangled affairs still untangled. There were beauty contests and the usual freak accidents and statements by senators, profound and otherwise. And in Rome, an American company began the production of a movie about Cleopatra. And it's indicative of the excellence of world communications that the social life of the two stars involved was made manifest to considerably more people than the real Cleopatra reigned over in all of her days. But it was not only the frivolous that was gaining momentum as the year stalked toward its destiny. In March, the United Steelworkers reached agreement on a contract with the steel industry. It provided fringe benefit increases amounting to about 10 cents an hour for the first year and left wage questions for the next year. It was called a non-inflationary agreement, an obvious victory for the administration. Then, on Tuesday, April 10th, Roger M. Blau, chairman of the huge United States Steel Company, made an appointment with the president, appeared at the White House, and announced that United States Steel was raising the price of steel by $6 a ton. Furthermore, the press had already been advised. The president was shocked and, quite frankly, deeply angered. And what followed was a dramatic example of action on the new frontier. Every weapon was brought to bear. Public denunciation, pressure to split industry's ranks, the threat of loss of government contracts, moves toward criminal prosecution under the antitrust laws. It was intense, but it was brief. Just 72 hours after Mr. Blau's meeting with the president, United States Steel handed an announcement to the press. The price rise had been canceled. The announcement came a few minutes after 5 on Friday, April 13th. Forsythia in Pennsylvania and New York, a warm breeze across Georgia, and the year was no longer young. April and the year was no longer a child, and April gave way to May. And as with all growing up, there were pains and stress. Dead bodies on the streets of Algiers. This country resumed nuclear testing in the broad reaches of the Pacific. And on May 28th, rumblings too from Wall Street. On that day, the New York Stock Exchange recorded the wildest one-day drop since 1929. The last figure finally limping across the ticker at 5:51 p.m., hours after the close of trading. More issues declined than had ever before done so in one day. American Telephone slipped 11 points. General Motors, 4 3/8. Standard Oil of New Jersey, down 5 points. DuPont, 12.5. Later in the week, there was a rally and the stocks recovered. It was not a calamity. This was Keith Funston speaking, the president of the New York Stock Exchange. People are selling to protect profits they have already taken. This was a song a lot of people were humming that May. It would be one of the year's big hits. It was called Moon River. Two Russian cosmonauts circled the Earth, one 64, the other 48 times. They came close to each other in space, but the Russians insist they did not attempt a rendezvous. We sent another man in orbit and troops to Southeast Asia and watched television and speculated on the potential of pitchers and shortstops and listened to the music. And then suddenly, a memory we had all tried to expel. It was like a final agonizing echo from World War II. The scene was Romley Prison just outside Tel Aviv, night and a dense fog. And inside, Adolf Eichmann, one-time Gestapo officer involved in the extermination of 6 million European Jews, ate his final meal, drank half a bottle of red Israeli wine, and marched to the gallows. His last remarks were a repetition of his defense. "I had to obey the rules of war and my flag," he said. "I am ready."
Oder nicht an dem ersten Anklagepunkt.
Im Sinne der Anklage nicht schuldig.
His body was cremated and strewn over the dark waters of the Mediterranean. From Brazil, the first rhythms of a new sound. Bossa Nova, they called it. The new wave. And it broke against our shores. And then a day, more properly a night, when all music seemed to end.
You get your autograph, Mr. Smith.
Wow, nigga. This is the campus of the University of Mississippi at Oxford, Mississippi. It was September 30th, and a new student had arrived to attend the classes of the fall semester. His name was James H. Meredith, and he's a Negro. He was not wanted there. They made it clear.
Hey, brothers.
There were about 2,500 persons assembled on the campus that night, not all of them students by any means. Many came from Oxford and other nearby cities. Meredith was brought to the campus by federal marshals. Someone opened fire, and there was a barrage of rifle bullets, iron pipes, rocks, bottles, and acid. The marshals tried to defend themselves with tear gas. When it was finally over, two persons had been killed and 375, including 166 marshals, had been injured. But Meredith stayed. And the long unresolved issue that has plagued us ever since our beginnings as a nation remained unsolved. Dawn came up over a cluttered campus, and there was the sound of military boots. But nothing seemed changed, really. One reporter noted that with the first streaks of the sun, a window in one of the dormitories was thrown open and a sleepy head appeared, surveyed the scene, and called out to the world at large, "Are there going to be classes today?" Rift was clear between Moscow and Beijing, and we learned a new and solemn word, thalidomide. There was a new heavyweight champion. The Yankees took the pennant again, and on October 20th, a startling development. Red Chinese troops crossed the border that separates India from Tibet. There was fighting. Krishna Menon, acid-tongued and bitter in his articulation of Indian neutrality, was deposed as defense minister. And the sons of men who had walked with Gandhi armed themselves and faced the enemy. But even this was not as startling as what came later. There were hints, looking back now. The president interrupting a political trip because of what seemed to be a trifling head cold, a gathering of the Security Council. But for most of the country, the news came on the evening of Monday, October 22nd. President Kennedy addressed the nation by radio and television.
I have directed that the following initial steps be taken immediately. First, to halt this offensive buildup, a strict quarantine on all offensive military equipment under shipment to Cuba is being initiated. All ships of any kind bound for Cuba, from whatever nation or port, will, if found to contain cargoes of offensive weapons, be turned back. Second, I have directed the continued and increased close surveillance of Cuba and its military buildup. Third, it shall be the policy of this nation to regard any nuclear missile launched from Cuba against any nation in the Western Hemisphere as an attack by the Soviet Union on the United States, requiring a full retaliatory response upon the Soviet Union.
And a blockade was announced. 13 hours later, Tuesday, the Soviet news agency TASS called the blockade piracy. But the response seemed mild in contrast to what it might have been. By Wednesday, it was clear that some Russian ships had changed course to avoid encounter with the American warships. The first meeting came on Thursday. A Russian tanker was stopped. She was not boarded, but it was ascertained, was the word used, ascertained, that she was not carrying missiles, and she was allowed to proceed. In the United Nations, there was intense activity. Adlai Stevenson, United States ambassador, lashed out, the phrase is proper, at Russia's Ambassador Zorin.
Fine flood of rhetorical scorn. All right, sir. Let me ask you one simple question. Do you, Ambassador Zorin, deny that the USSR has placed and is placing medium and intermediate range missiles and sites in Cuba? Yes or no? Don't wait for the translation. Yes or no?
And the story became somewhat confused. TASS announced that those weapons which the United States considered offensive would be removed if the United States took similar action at its bases in Turkey. The president rejected that, but it was revealed that Premier Khrushchev had sent an earlier message to President Kennedy in which no mention was made of Turkey or any other American bases. On October 20th, at a press conference, President Kennedy made this statement.
The evidence to date indicates that all known offensive missile sites in Cuba have been dismantled. The missiles and their associated equipment have been loaded on Soviet ships. And our inspection at sea of these departing ships has confirmed that the number of missiles reported by the Soviet Union as having been brought into Cuba, which closely corresponded to our own information, has now been removed. In addition, the Soviet government has stated that all nuclear weapons have been withdrawn from Cuba and no offensive weapons will be reintroduced.
And it was as if the whole world let out a sigh and began freely to breathe again. What had happened, in truth? There are many interpretations, but this I think. Two giants had faced each other at the brink of violence, and one, the one who had blustered for so long and had carped and irresponsibly rattled its weapons, withdrew from the act of violence. It was simply made clear to Russia that given sufficient provocation, we too are capable of anger and even gestures toward the brink, and that the business of maintaining the peace is a mutual endeavor. The elections were an anticlimax. The Democrats did well for a non-presidential year. Another Kennedy was elected in Massachusetts. And in California, Richard M. Nixon, defeated in a race for the governorship, made a remarkable statement to the press. He was tired after the long campaign, and he was disappointed. He had been both of these before, yet this time it showed.
Of the other candidate. Last point. I leave you gentlemen now, and you will now write it, you will interpret it, that's your right. But as I leave you, I want you to know, just think how much you're going to be missing. You don't have Nixon to kick around anymore. Because, gentlemen, this is my last press conference, and it will be one in which I have welcomed the opportunity to test wits with you. I have always respected you. I have sometimes disagreed with you. But unlike some people, I've never canceled a subscription to a paper. And also, I never will. I believe in reading what my opponents say.
And with the voices that were real, a voice that was not. This sound on record players across the country.
Family, family, family. Jack, there's just too much family. Can't we ever get away alone?
Tomorrow. I promise tomorrow we'll go away together tomorrow. No more family for a while now, I promise. Now, turn off the light. Good night, Jackie.
Good night, Jack.
Good night, Bobby. Good night, Ethel.
Good night, Jack. Good night, Teddy. Good night, Teddy.
Snow in the north and west and talk of Christmas. And in Rome, a gathering of prelates, an ecumenical council in the huge cathedral of St. Peter, the first since the last century. And they will meet again and probe those huge questions that the church must face and solve, even as individuals, as members corporate of the 20th century. Snow in the Rockies in the year was racing toward its end, and it was almost time for a summing up, an examination of those impersonal statistics that make birth and death and all intimate things a matter of record, an inclined curve on a chart, a factor of mathematics. Sometime during the year, it seems certain, enough families migrated into California to make it the most populous state in the Union. And there were voices that we once heard that we would not hear again, not fresh and new. Ernie Kovacs. He was 42. He died in an auto crash January 13th in Los Angeles. And the list, as it must each year, began to grow. Bruno Walter, Clem McCarthy, Jerry Geisler, the Reverend Dr. H. Richard Niebuhr, Fritz Kreisler, Owen D. Young, and two splendid actors, Charles Laughton and Thomas Mitchell, E.E. Cummings, William Faulkner, and poignantly, Marilyn Monroe. And when the news came, there was a sentence or two that came tumbling back.
As I say, the thing I like the most is to become a real actress. And I remember when I was a kid sitting in the front row at the movies on Saturday afternoon, and I would never come out of the movie. They'd have to come and get me, you know, I'd sit in the front row. And I think how wonderful it would be to be an actress and so forth. But I didn't really realize about acting, except I appreciated what I saw. Bad, good, it didn't matter. I enjoyed it very much, everything that I would see.
And on November 7th, in the city of New York, Mrs. Franklin Delano Roosevelt, born Anna Eleanor. She was 78. She left many words behind and many books. But of all the words, I think these are perhaps the most revealing. She was asked once what had been her aim in life, and in modesty and dignity, made this response.
I don't think I have any particular aim any more than I've ever had. I will go on doing whatever comes to hand to do. And I would like to be busy, but I don't think I have any particular aim. I would like to see the UN succeed. I would like to see a more peaceful atmosphere grow in the world. I don't expect to see it in my time, but I would like to feel that as much as could be contributed to it, I had contributed. I like to see liberal causes succeed, because I think it's important, if we're going to stay a democracy, that they do succeed. But I don't have any specific aim. I've just done things as they came along to do too long in my life. I guess I would just go on until the end, just doing things that happened to come my way.
Year of Grace, 1962. And for each of us who lived through it, there would be a separate story. For we cannot tell the real story. The vacation in that little place in Maine, and vows exchanged and illness expelled, and all the countless sad and happy things that come to each of us. For this belongs to you, and some of it to me, and it is beyond the telling. And now we face a new year, and it will begin as this one did. And some of the voices will be new, and others missing. But the song will be the same, and the hopes, and the dreams, as they have always been and always will be. And the end is like the beginning, and the words are the same. Happy New Year. May it be so, in truth, for you and me, and for all of us.